Yeah, so today we want, the goal is to tell you a little bit about the standard Landau theory of spontaneous symmetry breaking phase transition. I mean, really, you can, if you want to read more, you can find this essentially on any modern textbook on STEMEC. Landau volume 5, for example. Or if you want a more modern one, Carter's book is a pretty good place to read. So the goal today is to study spontaneous symmetry breaking. And I'll just call it SSB later this class. But more specifically, near a continuous phase transition. So I'll define all these terms as we go on. Okay. So the input of the theory is actually quite minimal. So we'll, at the end of the day, in our context, we want to study the theory for the superconductor. For example, as I gradually cool down a metal, when I reach TC, something funny happens. So I want to study the physics there. For that, we have the BCS, the microscopic BCS mean field theory, and so on. But it turns out this theory, this approach by Landau is even more general than that. So the input is that in general, I have some system, let's say some 3D system, and I assume a symmetry G. And in our case, it's just the U1 symmetry that rotates a fermion operator, let's say, with either spin up or spin down by a phase factor. Let me use theta over two, theta. And by the way, this symmetry corresponds to the conservation of the electron charge or electron number. You've probably seen something like this in your QFT class. So that's a symmetry. And then another input is an order parameter. In general, it could be, we call it phi. But in our case, it's the gap of the of the BCS order, or if you like, it's roughly proportional to up to this interaction constant, which let me not worry about it too much here. The pairing amplitude, the expectation value of the Cooper pair and annihilation or creation operator. And the important thing is that this order parameter is an observable that transforms non-trivially under the symmetry. Or if you like, it forms a non-trivial representation of the symmetry G. Under G. Because in our case, delta, since it's a CC, the expectation of CC under U1 symmetry transform, it goes to like e to the I 2 theta delta. Okay. And the assumption is that this order parameter obtains a non-zero expectation value in some in some situation. Okay. So Yeah, here, let me write it this way. So what do I mean by a continuous transition? A continuous phase transition, well, it has some other definition. But one way to think about it is to say that as I gradually lower the temperature, at some high temperature, the expectation is zero. But then at some TC, remember from BCS, the expectation of delta goes like this. So near here, there's something non-smooth, so this curve is not entirely smooth, but at least delta is continuous. So in contrast, a discontinuous one, sometimes also known as first order transition, that can look like this. Delta t. So as I go to some tc, it jumps. And then it goes like this. So we'll be focusing on this scenario. It's in general more interesting. And well, it also happens to be true if you just do BCS mean field calculation. So if I'm near a continuous transition, which means let me focus on this region near TC, then the absolute value of delta is going to be pretty small. And you know, whenever physicists see something small, you expand around that small number, right? That's how we make a living. So in this case, let's think about the free energy density. Let me call it F as a function of delta. And it can be also a function of temperature, pressure, and so on. But in this case, beside temperature and pressure, you put also in delta to see how it depends, right? So it will depend on some constant. There's some constant piece that's not particularly interesting. And then plus something like this. Plus dot, dot, dot. So dot, dot, dot means higher order stuff, right? That's what I mean by expanding. Right, so if you think about it up to this fourth order, you realize that's all the terms you can have, because this F should obey the symmetry of delta. So F should be invariant if delta goes to e to the I 2 theta delta, because that's basically what I mean by symmetry, manifested at the level of free energy. Right? So terms like delta and delta Q, they're not allowed because they're not invariant. Now you can ask, can I have something like absolute value delta? Well, that's not analytic. So if I assume the free energy is analytic in delta, well, analytic is a strong word, but smooth in delta, then you don't expect a kink, like a wedge dependence. So this we also forbid. And then these are the only terms you have. Essentially, you write everything in delta mod square. Okay. So the fact that I'm writing everything else as delta dot 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 suggests that I don't actually care. So let me not care about that. This is justified if delta is sufficiently small. And that's why this thing normally works pretty good, works pretty well near, if I'm sufficiently, reasonably close to a second order transition. But in fact.
So all second order phase transitions are characterized by having zero delta on one side and then having a non-zero delta.
most of them. There are weird exceptions, but for this kind of spontaneous symmetry breaking type of continuous transition, that's true.
We're only focusing on those.
Yes. Right, so, but in fact, even if I'm somewhere here, where strictly I shouldn't just stop at fourth order, this theory qualitatively still works reasonably well for real life superconductors. Right? So let's just stop at quartic order. But if I really want to stop at quartic order, that requires this number B to be greater than zero. Because we know that thermodynamic equilibration means that I want to minimize my free energy F. So if B is negative, then this is minimized by setting setting delta to infinity. That doesn't sound like a stable situation. Well, if that happens, actually, that means that you should expand to higher order. But let's assume B is larger than zero, so that phi doesn't go to infinity equilibration. And then let's look at what this piece looks like. Well, the constant, we can forget about it. So let's just plot this f as a function of this delta. There are two cases. One is if a is larger than zero, then it's a pretty boring curve like this. This is positive definite. Or you can try to plot it with a negative. Then it turns out it looks like this, which is anticipated because if delta is very large, then that quartic term dominates. So you should just be like monotonically increasing. But if delta is very small, then this quadratic term dominates. And then if a is negative, you should say a negative parabola first, before you start to realize that there's a quartic term. Okay. So this general form is anticipated. And what's interesting here is that, so I'm only plotting the real line, but if delta is a complex number, then you should imagine a complex one. You rotate this thing by a circle. Okay. What's interesting is that there are let me call this value delta naught, that's non-zero, that minimize f. So if I'm at thermal equilibrium, I want to minimize f, then I should pick this delta zero. Okay. And because of the symmetry, so delta zero multiplied by any phase factor, let me call it alpha, for any alpha is equally good. Right? But the thing is, the system is only going to pick one. Right? So we assume delta has a given expectation value. So that means once a value of alpha is picked, the symmetry, the U1 symmetry is broken by the solution. So this is what we mean by spontaneous symmetry breaking. So roughly speaking, it's saying that your problem or your Hamiltonian or your theory has that symmetry, but your solution doesn't. So any solution will inevitably break that symmetry.
So there's an observation that we could do to test on which delta zero, on which alpha we are.
For superconductor, it's actually tricky. I'll say it later, because there is a subtlety that in superconductor, it's actually a gauge symmetry. So here, I'm not assuming I haven't talked about gauge symmetry at all. But for example, this theory works also for magnet. And for magnet, that alpha is really just the analog of the angle to which your magnet points toward. That's obviously an observable.
You're the same as like anomalies in GR or in RG. Like,
no.
Can you talk about an anomaly and that renormalize?
No.
No.
Actually, it's the exact opposite of anomaly because anomaly really come from UV. While this is a pure IR thing. Okay, so excuse me. So that suggests that if I want to. That suggests that the funny thing should happen exactly at a equal to 0. So above, so when a larger than 0, delta is 0. Once a becomes less than 0, that kind of non-zero growth kicks in. Okay. Which means to first order, I can basically write my a as alpha times t minus tc plus terms that are higher order in tc in this thing. Again, I expect. This is reasonable as long as I'm sufficiently close to the phase transition. So for t smaller than tc, now you take this minimization condition. Now it's just pretty simple algebra. You just do it. You realize that the solution is that this delta has small square that's equal to minus a over 2b, which in this case is alpha over 2b times tc minus t. Okay, so delta, the value of delta goes as square root of tc minus t. Now you plug this into the free energy density, it goes like this. Which means if I measure the specific heat, so free energy by itself is not quite measurable, but if I measure the specific heat, which people do measure in the lab, it goes like 0 if T is larger than Tc, but alpha squared over 2b times T if T is less than Tc. By the way, this alpha is greater than 0. Of course, that's just the heat, the specific heat from the contribution of delta. There are other sources of contribution to specific heat. But they tend to be smooth as I go across Tc, because they don't see what's going on with delta. So in general, I should add some smooth function of T. So in practice, what you will see as I lower the temperature and keep measuring specific heat is that you'll do something at high temperature. And then at Tc, you'll have a jump because it's 0 above and then have additional piece. And then going down. And this is pretty much what people always observe, at least in conventional superconductors. This is observable and observed. Which is pretty amazing if you think about it, because you didn't actually have a theory of what's really going on with the delta. You just assume that it orders at some temperature continuously. Then this prediction follows. Another thing is I expect if I'm in thermal equilibrium, delta should probably be uniform. It's reasonable to assume that if delta fluctuates in space, then that costs me some free energy. So that means that if I introduce fluctuation of delta in space, I should add another term to my Hamiltonian, which is something like, well, okay, I need to give this thing a symbol. Let me call it M tilde. It's probably not a good symbol, but partial delta square, and then plus my alpha t minus tc square plus b. That's just saying if I have a spatial gradient in delta, that costs me more energy.
So what is coefficient?
Yeah, it's some number. I just call it m tilde. But
okay, it's too light. I cannot see.
Oh, so dark or too light?
Too. It's too.
Oh, okay.
Oh, m tilde.
Yeah, it's not gonna be. I won't actually use this symbol again later. Yeah, this is not the most convenient choice of unit. I'll rescale things later too. So don't worry about that number. Okay. Yeah, so these are known as the Landau theory of continual phase transition. And let me make a few comments. Right. So actually, put it here. So the first question you should by the way, let me make sure you haven't done this in your STEM class, right? No. Okay. Yeah, just make sure I'm not getting you bored. several comments. The first one is, why should I believe that? Because if I'm serious about doing STEMAC, what I should be considering is a partition function that looks like this, right? Meaning, this order parameter delta is a fluctuating degree of freedom. So if I want to think about the statistical distribution and so on, I should really seriously do a partition function, which is defined that way, right? In fact, if I replace, if I just change the symbol and replace that delta by phi, this is the phi-4 scalar theory you've seen in your QFT class. Now I know that for sure because I saw the board, right? So in general, you should do that. Now, once you do that, you realize that for any finite size system, this z is always smooth in whatever parameter you have. In particular, it should be smooth in t. Simply because as long as it's finite, it's a finite integral. You can't get weird stuff. And in particular, so that's one thing. So that's basically saying you shouldn't anticipate any phase transition. Like phase transition is when the free energy has some weird dependence. For example, here, the second derivative of the free energy is not continuous. Yes.
On top of the finite size, do we need to be on a lattice or?
That's less important actually. As long as your UV is reasonably tamed, you can choose any UV regularization. Yeah, but yeah. Of course, the theory better be UV complete. But this phenomenon is an IR phenomenon. That's why the exact UV completion doesn't really matter. Guess basically I'm saying as long as your theory is defined.
What about the difference between treating this partition function with the free energy and not the energy?
Oh,
having an F there instead of an H.
Yeah, so if you like, you can think of this F. It's really H, but the way to think about it is all the when you write down this form, what happened is that all your other degree of freedom beside this delta has been integrated out. So this F almost looks like a Hamiltonian, except it's not really necessarily the microscopic Hamiltonian. Remember, microscopic, you have all the electrons floating around. So you should have a bunch of Grassmann integral here. Right? So by writing down this form, you've integrated out all those things already. Yeah, but it, you know, calling it F or H or E doesn't really matter. It's just simple. But you will have an interpretation of F naturally, as I will show you. But first, so okay, no singularity expected. The other way to think about it is that if I look at this partition function, if I look at this path integral or summation over all delta, obviously, if delta, for example, if delta around delta 0 contributes to some number, then delta 0 multiplied by any phase factor should contribute equally, just by symmetry. Right? That's what I mean by symmetry. So this thing should contribute equally for any theta. Which means if I try to evaluate in the partition function the expectation of delta, I'm guaranteed to get 0. Just by the symmetry. So what am I doing there when I say delta picks up some non-zero value? Well, it turns out all this argument more or less break down if I actually go to the thermodynamic limit, which is L goes to infinity. So like so this thing has a name. It's called thermodynamic. Am I doing this, writing it right? Anyway, yeah. Okay. So there are several ways to, yes?
Why is it going that way?
Essentially, you have your, I'm not sure. Maybe that's the limit you start, you know, thermodynamics start to be justified. I give you 10 atoms, you're not supposed to do thermodynamics. All right, so there are several ways to think about this. So one way is to say that the saddle point approximation becomes justified, which really means this. So I replace that integral by just the integrand, but evaluate it at some stable point. Right. So this kind of approximation we've probably seen before. So this will be justified if this, it will be better justified if this number is infinite. So this is better justified if L goes to infinity. Okay. So that's when you can possibly see something singular. Right? And in fact, it does happen that if you take the limit properly, the free energy you end up getting being singular in time. Right, then you get a phase transition. So another way to think about it, is you think about the fate of this delta. So let's say if L is finite, and suppose this delta has this expectation non-zero expectation value delta naught at some time. So then by fluctuation, here fluctuation can either be thermal or quantum. So thermal or quantum. So in the specific case we consider here, We're doing it at finite temperature near TC. So the fluctuation will be thermal in nature. But suppose I think about similar phenomena as, let's say, at zero temperature, then the fluctuation will come from quantum mechanics. Okay? So by some fluctuation, a region can become a different value, let's say delta naught times another phase factor. But this is penalized by the gradient gradient term, because this creates a non-uniformity in delta. By that, partial x delta squared. Unless this fluctuation happens everywhere. If it happens everywhere, then it's uniform again. Then nothing penalizes. Okay.
What do you mean by happening everywhere? Is that there is a new value everywhere?
Yes. Yes, by fluctuation. But we assume that fluctuations are independent in space. Really, that means that you have some notion of locality in your theory. Okay. So some fluctuation, either by thermal or by quantum, happens at somewhere is in general uncorrelated with a fluctuation happens far away. Right? Yes.
Sorry, I don't see why it is going to be penalized by that factor.
Oh, you have, let's say, a region that's delta, another region, let's say, by delta e to the I theta. There's some non-uniformity here. So that causes you more energy, more free energy, by this term. Yeah. So this term really wants your delta to be uniform.
So the partial is like the boundary, like partial x.
Oh, sorry. No. This you're like gradient. Yeah.
Sorry. Talk more about
quantum fluctuation in this case. Yeah. Good. Actually, let me finish this sentence and then I can tell you. But fluctuation, as long as they are independent in space, this uniform fluctuation where you shift the phase angle uniformly. It's getting increasingly difficult if L is large. If I have only 10 atoms, that's probably not too hard. I wait for a little bit time, that will happen. But if I have 10 to the 23rd, it's getting really hard. So this fluctuation, in general, will take time tau to happen, and tau goes to infinity as L goes to infinity. Okay. So if I only have 10 atoms, I probably wait for a second, and then that will happen. But if I have 10 to the 23rd, I probably have to wait for the age of the universe or something longer for that to happen. So then practically, the symmetry is broken.
Okay. Can you repeat that argument again?
Yeah, let's think about thermal fluctuation. Then I want to go from delta to, let's say, minus delta. Okay. If I create a bubble, that's not good, because the energy is going to penalize. So I need a fluctuation that more or less flips everybody. But fluctuations are independent in space. So that means I have to have many independent fluctuations, many exactly same independent fluctuations to happen at the same time in exactly the same way.
It's like saying that it's not originating anywhere, it's like happening uniformly.
Yeah.
How can we take that assumption? I mean,
No. You need that effect to have any, because if you just do this, you get a high energy, and then the system will relax back to the equilibration quickly. I mean, I'm not saying this doesn't happen. This could happen, but then you are out of equilibration, then your system should go back to equilibration. Okay. So the quantum case. All right, Lynn, since you asked, so let me say a little bit about the quantum case. So let's talk about the ground state wave function. So now let me not do Landau free energy. Well, you can do it with some modification, but let me not do that. Let me just think about the ground state wave function. So remember, the Schreifer wave function I wrote you looks something like this, right? C dagger, k up minus k down. But in general, so where v and u are some real numbers. In general, nothing stops me from thinking about a wave function that looks like this. Can you see what I'm writing here? Yeah. No? Actually. Yeah. So the original one I wrote for you is theta equal to 0. But in general, I can choose pick any theta here. And because they differ by some U1 phase rotation on this C dagger operator, so they are related by symmetry. So they will work as well as the original theta equal to 0 wave function I wrote for you. You put it into, for example, measure the expectation of ground state of the Hamiltonian, it's going to be as low as the theta equal to 0 one. Okay, that's guaranteed by symmetry. So then why do I just pick a uniform phase? You say that's not fair. Just pick a particular phase. That's not fair. You should try to, if possible, pick all phases. Right? There is a way to do that in quantum mechanics. That's just doing a superposition. Right? So in general, what one could do, I didn't prepare for this. So again, everything should be correct up to some signs and funny factors. But what one can do, well, another way to say that is that if I look at this wave function, it doesn't have conserved charge or conserved electron number. Right? So it's not an eigenstate of charge. Or if you like, charge conservation is broken. So if I want to restore charge conservation, so I want to say I want a state with a specific number of charges, number of electrons. Let's say that number, let me call it Q. So how does that work? That works like this. Let me call that number n. Okay? So that's the total number of electrons, n e. Then the way it works is d theta e to the I n e theta omega theta. So essentially, I take some superposition of all possible thetas, possibly weighted by some factor. It turns out this factor will be measuring the number of electrons. Maybe there's a sign here. So this thing is fully symmetric. There's no spontaneous symmetry breaking, naively, if you stare at this wave function. Again, because now you take this wave function, you measure the expectation value of C dagger, it's zero, because now it has the full symmetry. Okay. So what's going on, right? So what is going on is that on a finite size system, it turns out this is the better ground state. if you really plug it, some wave function of this form into the Hamiltonian, it has lower energy than this one, right? Which is expected, because you expect the ground state to actually have the full symmetry. However, as the system size becomes larger and larger, what happens is that in terms of energy, these two becomes pretty much indistinguishable. The energy spread between this one and this one, the energy difference between this one and this one is goes down to zero as L goes to infinity. And a worse thing is this state actually looks like a Schrodinger's cat. So if this is not obvious enough, let me give you a simpler example. So if you think about icing ferromagnets, say that, let's say if I have a 1D chain of icing ferromagnets, you know what icing model is, right? Okay. So
you meant random walk.
Classically, we say that the zero temperature looks like all up or all down. But then, you can say quantum mechanically, why can't I fantasize this state, all up plus all down? This state is the analog of this superposition. And you can see quite manifestly that this has the full Ising symmetry. You flip the spin, it's the same state. Okay. So why do we say there is a spontaneous symmetry breaking in Ising model if this is the true ground state? For two things. One is if the system size goes to large enough, the energy between this and simply just all up becomes vanishing as L goes to infinity. In fact, in this case, it vanishes exponentially. I think this case is better. It's probably a power law. But even worse, this is a cat state. Right? You measure a single spin, the entire wave function collapses. That's the definition of Schrodinger's cat. Okay. So, which means practically you're not going to see it. This is like saying I give you a magnet that's all up and all simultaneously all down. It's going to be extremely fragile. Okay. So, practically the only observable states are of this sort.
So, is that what the symmetry breaking is?
Yes, that's what really gives you symmetry breaking in ground state of many body quantum mechanics. Yes.
What is the physical meaning of the cat end?
Sorry?
What is the physical meaning of the cat end?
Yes. So this is the state. So this is the state in a superconductor with a definite charge or number of electrons, NE. And in fact, if I have a small superconductor that's completely isolated from the external world, then that thing should have a total. Fixed total charge. In fact, there the wave function will actually look more like this.
So I still have a question about omega theta. So
yes.
Is it the ground state for, is this still a ground state?
Well, it's a mean field ground state, right? Now, remember, if I take out if I set theta to zero, this is the Schreiber tri wave function
yes. We
talked about. Right, I'm saying any theta will actually be equally good.
Yes, but then you need to correct that definition of the gamma.
Oh yeah. The gammas will be, the definition of gammas will be slightly modified. Will be modified.
Yes. Right. So if you decide the value of theta, then you will decide the gamma. The
yeah,
gamma.
Yeah.
So not vary the theta all the time. Right?
What do you mean by
I'm saying you should only assign a value to theta, not to integrate out.
Well, it turns out this theta will basically be the phase of the delta.
Mm-hmm.
So as a matter of fact, the phase of delta will be important. And if I put up electric field or magnetic field, that phase responds in a non-trivial way.
Mm-hmm.
That's ultimately what gives me all the funny things about superconductors, Meissner effect, and so on. So it is an important angle. Variable. Yes?
Can you repeat your argument about symmetry breaking for the cat state?
Yeah. The thing is, the true ground state, which has the full symmetry, is a cat. The way to see it is, for example, you measure any single spin. You don't even have to do it yourself. The environment will do it for you. Then the entire state collapses to this, or the other. Okay, that's the quickest way to see it. Of course, the better way to see it is to say that if you measure correlation function of any sort, for example, let's call this thing sigma z. If you measure correlation function like this, you realize and you take the state to be this superposition. You realize that these two components never talk to each other. It's always correlation function from this piece and correlation function from this piece. You can actually putting multiple point correlation function that'll also be the same. So these two are so strongly orthogonal that they never talk to each other. And practically, in any given universe, you only observe one component. That's basically the physics of state collapse and so on. Yes.
If you do have sigma x inside, then they would talk to each other because.
No, if you have sigma x, you flip one spin. Right, they still don't talk to each other. Right. You have to.
The correlation function.
No, you have to have L number of operators multiply together. Right. So any local finite number won't communicate between the two. Yes?
Can we say the same about the thermal fluctuations, or are they different?
Well, the thermal fluctuation, that's why I said you can have quantum fluctuation. It works more or less the same way, right? Because you can view this superposition as a result of quantum fluctuating this one to this one, mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, that's another way to see it. So the ground state, you can say, has the almost ground state has two states. This all up, let me just represent by this. It really means all up and all down, right? So you can say that there are two eigenstates. Let me call it plus minus. That's all up plus minus all down. They are all symmetry eigenstates of this spin flip symmetry, one with a positive eigenvalue, one with negative eigenvalue, right? But you can say, what's the energy between these two? Right, so they'll have different energy in general. And that energy will be of the same order as the energy between this state and the true ground state. It turns out in this particular case, it's going to be exponentially small in system size. We'll see something called correlation length. So that I won't show you how it actually works, but it's in general small. In this case, it's not as bad. It's not exponential, but still it's vanishing as L goes to infinity. Okay. Now let me play the old trick, the trick that I always play. What is this? How do I interpret this energy uncertainty? Well, this energy difference. Let me interpret that as inverse of some time scale. So that's the time scale. You can think of it as the time you need for a quantum fluctuation to take you from this state to this state, from all up to all down. And that diverges badly as L goes to infinity. Yes?
Can I view correlation length as the distance or like the separation between these fluctuations or patches? Or?
More or less, yeah. Right, so that's the quantum case. Yeah, so this is what I mean by the time it takes for a quantum fluctuation to flip all the spin. Okay. I've even said this. Maybe let me just as well give you the more precise definition of spontaneous symmetry breaking. I mean, you've seen that if you don't think, just blindly do Landau, then it's pretty straightforward. And then once you start thinking, it gets pretty subtle. And that is true. So that's why there is a better definition of spontaneous symmetry breaking, which is called the off-diagonal long-range order. Essentially, you don't define the spontaneous symmetry breaking as the expectation value of a single order parameter, but you define it through the correlation function of order parameters. So a more precise definition. That is to say, if I measure my correlation function, let's say at some spatial coordinate x and y, but by let me assume translation symmetry, so that only depends on the difference between x and y. So I set one, actually, whatever. Let me talk about x and y. So the statement is, as the distance between x and y goes to infinity, or you can just say it goes to the order of the system size. Let me say practically of the order of the system size. This thing goes to a constant that's non-zero. So for uncorrelated random variables, they go to zero. And now, you interpret this constant as the separated expectation. This is interpretation. This may not be literally true for all the subtleties I mentioned. For example, if you happen to work with a cat state without knowing that, then you measure the expectation of a single order parameter, it's going to be zero. Okay? But then you measure this thing, it's still a non-zero constant as the distance goes to infinity. This gives you the delta squared. Okay? So that's why this is a better, a more satisfactory definition, because you know, this is obviously true if I just work with simple lambda mean field, because there, if delta actually has a non-zero expectation value, this obviously gives me a non-zero number, even as distance goes to infinity. But even for subtle things like cat state and so on, this definition will still work. So this has a name. It's known as the off diagonal. I think off diagonal because x and y are different, long range order. All right, so let's take a 5-minute break. And then also, let me just give you a fact without proof. You may see the argument for that in your QFT class. That I'm less sure. But in 3D, which is what we care about in this particular case, the spatial fluctuation or just fluctuation, let's say, the fact that you know you should really do a proper path integral instead of just taking the saddle point does not invalidate our analysis. Mean field. Unless t is too close to tc. And as a matter of fact, turns out that I may be able to show you a little bit later. For BCS superconductor, the one that's properly, that can be adequately described by the mean field theory I told you about earlier this week. This is, it's going to be too close to be observable. Meaning you have to be like at TC, let's say TC some 5 Kelvin. Then you have to go to TC minus 0.00001 Kelvin to even see see phenomena that's different from the mean field prediction. So that's not doable. For other more exotic superconductors, like high temperature superconductor, the situation is better. It's different. So for example, that specific heat prediction that you have a jump, that's seeing all the BCS superconductors. But if you actually do the path integral properly, if you know how to do it, the behavior is actually modified. But in BCS superconductor, nobody actually can observe that.
So is it a special property of the BCS superconductor?
Yes, yes, yes. It happens to, it has to do with the fact that the gap is way too much smaller than Fermi energy.
For the BCS superconductor, if you did the proper treatment, would the specific heat actually diverge completely? Or?
Yes, if you go close enough to, actually, let me just tell you the result. So to see phenomena that deviates from mean field, what you need is something like this. T minus TC minus T is of the order TC times delta or TC over Fermi energy to the fourth power. So that's the result for BCS. So typically EF is like 10,000 Kelvin. TC is like several Kelvin, let's take 10. So this is 1/1,000 raised to the fourth power, and then times the TC, which is already just like 10 Kelvin. So think about the number, the accuracy of temperature you need to see this effect. It's basically hopeless. Yeah, that's why somehow for BCS superconductor, which is described by some weakly coupled electron phonon that induces a pairing at very low energy, the Landau mean field is pretty much always sufficient. Okay. But if you really go into regime where this is even smaller than that, then you have to actually apply your knowledge learned from field theory to do the path integral properly. And let me also comment a little bit about the power of Landau theory. So the power of Landau. The power is really that, I haven't been working with an actual microscopic theory. I haven't told you what's the Hamiltonian for my electron. Right? What I've done entirely is to assume that there is some symmetry. And that symmetry is spontaneously breaking somehow through a continuous phase transition, right? So the input is just symmetry and the assumption that the symmetry, let me call it G, that G somehow spontaneously breaks. Three continues. And this is what makes it powerful, because the only thing that I don't know at this point is that I don't know the number alpha and b and m tilde. So to have that, I need a microscopic theory. For example, that those numbers can be computed from the BCS mean field theory. The actual computation is a little bit involved, so I won't actually show you how to do that, but it's computable. So a microscopic theory. Something like, by microscopic, I mean starting from a Hamiltonian and try to solve it in some way, like BCS, is needed only if I want to do two things. So only if, so it's needed only for, first of all, establish that this asymmetry, spontaneous symmetry breaking through a continuous transition exists. Because here, I assume that the symmetry somehow spontaneously breaks. Right? So it may or may not in the real system. Right? So that's the starting point. So to establish that starting point, you need a microscopic theory, something like the BCS mean field. Okay? And second, if I want to compute those numbers like alpha, b, and m tilde in the land of free energy, there, right? The A and B's. Yes.
Sorry to go back again, but spontaneous—the word spontaneous and spontaneous symmetry making—does that mean that we don't know what's breaking the symmetry, or?
No. It means the theory has the symmetry. It's just your solution doesn't. There is okay. It's in contrast to another word, which is explicit symmetry breaking, which means your theory, means your Hamiltonian doesn't have that symmetry. And then you don't expect your solution to have that symmetry.
So we just say that we are not commenting on how it's happening.
It's happen. Yeah, in BCS, we know how it's happening. In Landau, you don't. In Landau, you assume it happens. Yeah. OK. And for this reason, even in situations where we don't have a microscopic theory, this Landau approach may still work. For example, in high-temperature cuprate superconductors, we don't actually know for sure microscopically what's causing the superconductivity. But as long as we know that it's a superconductor, then we can do Landau. It basically works. Of course, you won't be able to compute these numbers, but okay, there are some positive numbers. You can. There's some way to estimate. Okay. Also, the U1 symmetry can be any U1 symmetry. It doesn't have to be the charge U1. It doesn't have to be charge conservation. For example, you can think about an XY magnet. So there, the role of delta will be played, which is a complex number, will be played by this SX plus ISY. And many of the things we said here will also just apply there. If I think about a three-dimensional XY model. And further, the symmetry G doesn't even have to be U1, right? I mean, at least in that mean field analysis, we didn't really use the fact that delta is a complex number. If it was a real number, the argument will go through. It's just you replace the phase factor freedom by some sign, plus minus sign. Or it can even be a vector, right? So some examples. G can be SO3, then I'm talking about a Heisenberg magnet. G just a magnet. Right? Or G can be Z2. In the case of magnet, that order parameter is going to be replaced by a three-dimensional vector, right? Essentially SX, SY, SZ. And if G is Z2, then this is the Ising model, right? So where delta is replaced by a real number that this Z2 Ising acts as a sign under Z2.
So there doesn't even need to be a conserved charge?
Right.
Conserved quantity doesn't.
Well, yeah. Actually, for the case of Ising, there is a conserved charge. It just the conserved charge density doesn't exist. But there you go, that's some high order solid. So this is an early example of what we say universality. Of course, developed fully only after the invention of renormalization group. But already you see here that the idea is even without knowing the detail, many of the details of the microscopic model, the Hamiltonian of electrons and so on, one can say an awful lot about what is going on, just with some minimum assumptions. Okay. Yes. Okay. So now let me just. Show you that, right? So I said you don't need a microscopic theory to just write down the theory, but if you have a microscopic theory like the BCS, you can compute these numbers, and that has been computed. I just tell you the result. The actual computation is a little bit involved. So the computation looks the result looks like this. Let me write it as some function, some number delta f times square minus c square t square plus k square. Where delta f is 7. Zeta 3 and E 16 pi square MTC square. M is the electron energy, N is the electron density, and zeta 3 is the zeta function, this thing. It's a number. You know, if you want to train your muscle in doing integration and so on, just play with it. You can find the derivation in many books, like the Aberkosov book I mentioned last time has the derivation. Yes.
Is it different from the xi tau square? The term in the
this one?
Yeah.
Is it what? Yeah, I'll write down what this is.
It's not the zeta.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I think one is supposed to be. Yeah, this is supposed to be zeta, and then there's the. Yeah, okay. Anyway. Historically people decided to use unfortunate symbols. That's the best I can do. It's different, right? So actually this is assuming T is less than TC. For T larger than TC, there the definition of this C differs slightly. So the reason I'm writing on this way is this is called the correlation length. It's the analog of the coherence length I talked about before. It's some number 7 3 m squared over kf squared tc times tc minus t. Yeah. So it's, you see that it's some expression, right? And this C is called the correlation length, or sometimes I think also called the coherence length. And if T is much smaller than TC, you can see that if T is much smaller than TC, it's basically TC squared here. So if you take the square root, C is basically TC over EF, which is basically the coherence length we talked about last time. Remember, the interpretation of this coherence length at temperature much lower than TC, which is basically zero temperature, is that it's the size of the Cooper pair. So I said this can be 1,000 times larger than the actual electron-electron distance. So let me just quickly show you why it's called the correlation length. The reason is this. So if I forget about this delta, this overall constant, then if I look at this expression, remember I'm at temperature lower than TC. So I should have an expectation value delta naught that's given by that some expression there. Yeah, that one. Right. So now let me expand my delta as delta naught plus a little bit of fluctuation, delta there. Then you will see that my f will be proportional to up to that delta f constant, 1/2 partial x delta square, sorry, partial x delta square. Plus 1 over 2 c square delta square plus higher order terms. So if I only keep the quadratic order, it looks like this. So now this should look more familiar. This is basically the Gaussian, the free boson theory you've probably seen before. Except there, you call this a mass. And if you, for example, compute the correlation function in real space from this theory, you see that it decays exponentially as x over c. Just do the Fourier transform, get the propagator out, Fourier transform back, you get this expression. Okay? So that's why this is called the correlation length. It's saying if I somehow deviate slightly away from the equilibration value, which is delta zero, how quickly does that deviation die off? So that should die off because I'm out of equilibration. So this xi measures how quickly in distance that fluctuation dies off.
Is it related to the effective mass of the excitation?
In this case, not directly, because that effective mass has to do with time. And in this case, time and space is in this region are not exactly equivalent. But in some cases, yes.
Can you say more about, or like say that statement again about the correlation length and the coherence length?
Which statement? Like?
Yeah, like about the size of the Cooper pair.
Just saying that.
Should be EF over TC instead of TC over EF.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I meant to say this. Yeah, thanks. All right, so actually, yeah, I'm not sure if I want to cover this. So, okay, just a quick survey. In your QFT class, when you cover the 5-4 theory, did you learn that the 5-4 term has scaling dimension something? Like it's relevant in 3D, sort of? Okay, yeah, then I can say a little bit how you get the Ginsburg, sorry, how you get that how you get that fourth there. Okay. So essentially, remember the partition function is something like e to the minus this integral over space and then divide by temperature. And near the critical temperature, you can replace this by just Tc. Right? So then you can rewrite by doing some redefinition. Let's say I call it phi square root delta f over Tc times delta. You can rewrite everything. So this is what you will be integrating in the integrand of the part integral as 1/2 partial x. So this looks more probably more familiar because that's what you actually, that's the kind of unit you actually use in a typical phi-4 theory. Right. Let me call this number b, or b tilde just to differentiate from the earlier b. So it's some expression involving this delta f and this m squared over kf. Yes?
Sorry, just going back a little bit. Can you just remind us what the delta 0 is? And then secondly, would you mind moving your cup from the podium?
It's not even my cup. Can you? Man, I'm actually thirsty, but still. Yes, so so that delta naught is that thing, right? Remember when T is less than Tc, the equilibration value, which minimizes my free energy, has a non-zero value. That's the minus A over 2B, that's the alpha. So in this case, my A is this 1 over C squared, right? So it, and B is this number, I mean, times this, right? So this delta naught has a value, you know, just plug in those value, this has a value. The thing is, this delta delta is like doing, I repeat that the upper diagram there, this is my f, this is delta, it looks like this. Actually, can you see what I'm drawing? So the equilibration value is here. So this delta delta is like fluctuation around here or around the imaginary axis. Okay. Yes. So the reason you write it this way is because now your path integral, the integrand looks like this. So this is a thing that appears on the exponential. So it better be dimensionless overall. And now you have length dimension 3 here. So now let's count the dimension. So the dimension of this phi, because it has two derivatives here, should basically be square root of, should be minus 1/2. Okay? That's just dimension counting. Which means your 1 over c squared has dimension minus 2, which is what we expect. C has the dimension of length. Now you just do the counting, right? So this has minus 1/2, you have 4 of them, so that's minus 2. Am I doing it right? Yeah, I think I'm doing it right. And B tilde has the dimension minus 1. Okay, it's just dimension counting. So as I said, when is fluctuation important? Well, if I only keep things to quadratic order, there's no fluctuation. A Gaussian path integral is basically classical. That you're probably so the fluctuation will be important when the non-Gaussianity kicks in. So that's when, for example, this b tilde is comparable to c squared. But in what unit, right? They don't even have the same dimension. So when I say they should be comparable, I mean that this c square should be of order b tilde square. That's what makes that dimension match. Right. So if this b tilde, for example, square is, for example, larger than this 1 over c square, then this non-Gaussian term will start to have effect. And then you can no longer just trust your mean field. So if you plug this relation with all the relations here, because everything has a definitive expression here, you end up with that relation. And that is also known as the Ginsburg criteria. So that's it for today. So next time, before we leave. So far, I'm pretending that electromagnetic field doesn't exist. I haven't written down an A field there. So next time, we'll actually put in the electromagnetic field and see what's the effect of all this. And then you come to superconductivity and Meissner effect and all that. All right, that's it for today.
In your phi here, is it delta or is it delta? Are you expanding?
Delta. Delta times a normalization factor.
In principle, yeah. But the thing is, if you are sufficiently close to DC, then it doesn't really matter.
Oh, I see.